The Home Show with Sinead Ryan.
With Mila.
On News Talk.
Welcome to The Home Show with myself, Ciara Kelly, sitting in for Sinead Ryan this morning. Coming up on the show, what is it actually like to live the Bridgerton life? How to design your bedroom for maximum comfort? What did Irish people cook and eat back in the day in the 18th century? And Arlene McIntyre will be joining us to tell us about the influence influencers and celebs are having on interior design. If you'd like to get involved in the show this morning, you can email us at thehomeshow@newstalk.com or get in touch with myself on Instagram at @KieraKellyDoc. And remember, you can always listen back to the show anytime, any place, wherever you get your podcasts, on newstalk.com or on the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And also let us know what you think. You can always text the show 53106 at a cost of 30 cents. Or indeed, you can WhatsApp us for free, 087 1400 106. I'm very excited to be on the Home Show this morning because we are all about Bridgerton. It is, of course, the Bridgerton weekend. Second half of season three is dropping as we speak. People are glued to it and are binging on it all over the country. And we're going to be talking all about Bridgerton. I am, frankly, obsessed. Just absolutely adored. I adore everything from the costumes, the interiors, right the way down to Nicola Coughlan, who I think is a national treasure. But we'll talk about that in just a few moments' time. And in the meantime, you're very welcome to The Home Show. Two of season three of Bridgerton launches this week, and the series, which follows the lives of the Bridgerton family in Regency era London, has of course been unbelievably popular. But how does its popularity transfer to Regency era homes and living, and indeed hospitality here? And what's it like to live in such a house? Laura Bowe is co-owner and manager of Marlfield House in Goree County, Wexford, and she joins us now this morning. Good morning to you, Laura. I am lucky enough to have been to Marlfield House, and it is spectacularly beautiful, but I imagine it has its quirks. Is it easy to live in a Bridgerton-era home?
Morning, Ciara. Hi. Well, yes, it is easy to live in a Bridgerton-era home. I mean, it's obviously a very romantic setting that does require a lot of maintenance, just like it did 150 years ago. The property is there, was built in the Regency period. Everything is done in the same manner as it always was. The maintenance and the upkeep of the grounds and gardens are large, to say the least. But it is a very beautiful place to live. It does require constant love and care, though.
I can only imagine. I suppose you're saying it's the same as it was 150 years, but how we live has changed over 150 years ago. So first of all, we generally have less staff in our homes. We also are far, I suppose, more demanding about things like heat and insulation. Mm-hmm. Marlfield House would have a staff, obviously, but are things like keeping the place warm, are they very tricky?
Things like that are probably a huge part of our work annually. When we close in January or for a couple of weeks to do all our maintenance, you're constantly spending money where obviously the guest, your visitor, doesn't necessarily see, whether that's insulation, new plumbing, looking after the roofs, the old chimney stack, the grounds, replanting trees. There is a lot of care and maintenance. But in general, it's the below the stairs and above stairs continues in that sense that there's a behind the teams team of staff who work so hard to keep all that going. And like in the olden days, we tend to cross over. People who work in these older properties tend to work maybe in more than just one department. There might be a crossover between housekeeping and front of house. So there's a very much a holistic approach to how we do it, which might be slightly different to a commercial hotel.
Yeah, I love that. That's what you just said. Is it still has a kind of an upstairs, downstairs. And it makes sense that it would, because you have guests arriving and then obviously you have people beavering away behind the scenes, although they'd be, I suppose, staff rather than servants nowadays.
Exactly.
So very, very, very different roles in some ways, but doing more or less the same thing. Do you notice any kind of a Bridgerton bounce? Is there an element of people, because of the massive popularity of the show? I was interviewing Nicola Coughlan of this season's Bridgerton fame. She's obviously Penelope Featherington, and her popularity is incredible. Are you getting a bounce from it?
We definitely are. I mean, we're seeing, I think, in the, 15, 20 years ago with Celtic Tiger, I think these properties went slightly out of fashion for a while. everybody wanted something shiny, new and grey. But I think we've definitely reverted back to the old properties. And Bridgerton has definitely impacted that in the last 2 years. We really noticed an uptake in our afternoon teas where all the ladies gather. And it's the same thing, the whistle down effect where everyone's sitting and chatting. And there's obviously a little bit of gossiping going on and girls are catching up, whether it's for just a catch up or for an engagement or for a baby shower. We've had a huge uptake in afternoon teas, whether it's, and if it's in the winter, it's going to be in by the fire with the candles lit and lovely flowers. And then if it's in the summer, it's spilling out onto the garden and people are under a shady terrace. They love the whole idea of afternoon tea, and fresh pots of tea come out every half an hour and they could stay for up to 2-3 hours.
That's really, really interesting. And are a lot of your clientele, are they women? Is from what you're saying there, do you find you have more women coming to Marlfield than men? Is that a thing?
It's both, really. I mean, yes, it's so popular with ladies, but you'll always get the romantic couples. We have a lot of repeat business from our wedding guests. So the romantic country house wedding is very much in vogue around all the Blue Book properties. We are a member of Ireland's Blue Book.
Yeah.
And there's over 50 properties in Ireland, and a lot of them are heritage Regency properties like ourselves. And so they do attract wedding business, and then that business obviously brings back couples. So I would say it's also very coupley. So it's very much a mix. Downstairs this morning at breakfast, there's two groups of ladies, and then there's the rest of the room is all couples.
Yeah.
So we get a good mix.
I get the couples theme because they are quite romantic settings, places like Marlfield, aren't they? There is a romance inherently to them.
Yeah, and it's expected and anticipated. I mean, whether it's from the paintings, the lighting is so important, the lush setting. I mean, a lot of our rooms are very rich and they've got damask fabrics, and everyone loves a swag and tail, I think, and a four-poster bed. Even if it's only for one night, a man may not want to live in it all the time or sleep in it, but they do. Everyone loves that bit of fun.
I don't know, I've ever met a man that didn't like a four-poster bed. I think even they are like that. It's interesting you're talking about the interiors and the swags and all that kind of stuff, because you also mentioned the 50 Shades of Grey. Like, we have had very minimalist, you know, if you go into any show house in a housing estate, that grey palette, that lack of colour. But would you say Marlfield is more maximalist than minimalist?
I think we've kind of engaged in both. I think we went down that grey road as well, and it worked beautifully in some of our rooms on the panelling. It's very elegant, and then you can bring through the richness of your paintings and the fabrics with the cushions. So we've definitely toned it down. It's still a little bit very, very rich palette, mainly on the ground floor, but in some of the bedrooms it's a little bit more pared back.
Okay.
But we've kind of married the two.
So you've done a modern take on a Regency era sort of a thing.
Absolutely, in some of the rooms, yeah. But I think colour is back for sure.
You, your own background before, obviously Marlfield is a family business, and I know your parents before you were running it, but you've also worked in film and on film sets. Does the staging of a room, do you find that you actually still dip into that film experience with things like interiors?
Yes, completely. I do all the interiors in the hotel. So obviously I took back my experience from film, and I obviously got my love of design from my mom and from she was an interior designer as well. So I got it all from her. But yes, you do bring it back. It's constant staging, you know, whether it's the symmetry of the room, the plumping of the cushions, the setting of the lights, that they're too bright or too low. That never stops. You're constantly going around in circles, adjusting things, seeing the details. So I'm probably a little bit detailed obsessed. But I think to be in this business and in the country houses, hotel business, you need to have that eye for detail, because things can fall away and become, you know, shabby chic very quickly. So you have to, even though that can be very lovely too, but you need that balance. So yeah, I definitely brought my film experience. And in film, I would have done quite, I loved doing the period films as opposed to modern, because they involved a bit of research of the characters, the period, a lot of research, and then obviously sourcing those things, prices that you could afford from hire companies in London, or either making them up with cheaper fabrics and brocades that would look like silks. So it was a lot of
interesting. And so that's something I presume you would bring to your current setting. The detail, I think you're right. And I think very possibly people who would choose to come to eat or dine or stay in Marlfield would be people who would have an expectation around the look of the place and I suppose the opulence of the place. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, there is certainly an expectation from the minute they come through the front doors. Obviously, the lobby of these houses, our lobby is very grand. It was built in the 1980s, but it is set in a Regency style and it's beautiful. So it's very, a lot of drama when you walk in. And people do, they expect that. And then when they go out into the gardens, they expect to see, which they do a lot again, of the Blue Book houses like ourselves, the country houses, or the gardens have been set out over 100 years ago in the Regency or Georgian period, like our garden. So we have worked on our garden for 45 years. We're here 50 years, but it is the same original layout as it always was. So we're just replacing and replenishing what was there. Yeah. So there's something very romantic about that, to come into a house.
I remember
the garden and trees are so old, as old as the property.
The gardens are very beautiful in Marlfield, and they do, they look like old gardens. They have that look, even though they're very well maintained. And I remember having dinner down in your restaurant and looking out the window, and there was some peacocks just walking by. And I was kind of going, it was almost like, as I, you can maybe see your background in film, because it felt a bit like you were on a set, because it was so kind of atmosphere. I was like, oh, the peacocks, you know what I mean? Like, but it kind of all adds to it, doesn't it? There is an actual experience. Yeah.
There is an actual experience in something like the peacocks. You think, oh, that's so perfectly timed, and they arrange that. And no, it's something that, yeah, it's all part of that whole.
The peacocks are not actors. They're genuinely peacocks.
Well, they kind of are a little bit, but yeah, they know people love them and they always appear at the right moment. But yes, completely. I think the gardens are such a romantic space to be in. And I think people just love that. And there is a lot of drama around these houses.
It is fascinating that Bridgerton is such a phenomenon now that it is actually, I totally get why it would be, because I'm a little bit obsessed with it myself, but that it would create, I suppose, a fillip for places such as your own. I presume it's a good news story, this kind of fashion, this current fashion for it.
It definitely is. I think people are going, and when the next drop is this weekend of the last three episodes, I think they're going to bring on even more. And I know the clothing in Bridgerton is, the costumes this time are taking a little bit of artistic license or liberty, and they're very vibrant. But and they're amazing, but the backgrounds, the actual settings, those Regency rooms are, you know, if you look at them, they're stunning. And I'm sure they're catching people's eyes, and they're walking into places like the Merion or ourselves or Mount Jewish or Casha Palace, and they're seeing, you know, this is the interior that I'm watching. And I think that's what people will enjoy that. I think it will definitely bring a lot of business to these kind of properties. And why not? It's great. It's a great.
Look, and I'm sure it's very welcome. I know hospitality hasn't been an easy trade, as it were, for the last number of years. So the very best of luck with all that. And thank you very much for talking to us this morning. That is Laura Bow from Marlfield House. And great place to visit if you are in that neck of the woods. I have been down there several times, and it really is not just stunning to look at, but great, great place to get a bite to eat as well. Thanks very much, Laura.
Thank you so much, Kira.
Now, we've been talking about Bridgerton, and we've been talking about Marlfield House, and the huge, I suppose, interest and fashion people have in historical homes at the moment and all of that. And for more on this, a new exhibition has been launched at Strokestown Parkhouse in the last preserved 18th century gallery kitchen in Ireland. This is fascinating stuff. This is titled Food, Feasts and Footmen, and the exhibition sheds light on the culinary practices and the food preparation from the era. And I'm now joined by John O'Driscoll, Irish Heritage Trust General Manager at Strokestown Park and the National Famine Museum, and Regina Sexton, who is a Programme Manager in the MA in Food Studies and Food Ways at UCC. Guys, you're both very welcome, and I know you know each other as well, obviously. But John, I'll come to you first of all. This exhibition in Strokestown, tell us first of all when it's running, and tell us a little bit about how it's come about.
Oh yeah, hi Kira, thank you for having us on the show. It's currently running at the moment in Strokestown House, and it's there for everyone to see on the guided tour of the house. It's an amazing exhibition, because it kind of brings the dining room and the kitchen and everything to do with the servants and food preparation to life in the house. It came about, we were very lucky to get some funding. The Irish Heritage Trust got some funding from the Department of Tourism and from Westward Holdings, the company who owns Strokestown Park. And we got funding through the Regional Interpretation Grant. So really wonderful to have so many people come together and work on this. As I said, people would always go into the kitchen and the dining room in Strokestown. beautifully preserved, exactly as they had been. The galleried kitchen is one of the last of its type in Ireland. The gallery is above the kitchen, just to describe a gallery kitchen, and I know Regina will have more to say on this, but it's a gallery above the kitchen where the lady of the house could walk above the kitchen, overlook her servants, see everything, the food preparation, and just view the kitchen, maybe even with friends from other big houses. Again, it was a status symbol to have a beautiful kitchen like this in your house. And now the visitor comes in, they see the gallery, they see some menus, they see food preparation in that kitchen. You can see all the old stoves, the old ranges, they're all labelled, they're all named. There's servants are named, their roles, the years they were working in Strokes and House. There's food props, we'll call really, really good, you know, which are copying exactly what was there. There are old recipes from the archive on display. It's kind of getting ready. Regina, again, will have more to say on this.
I'd be asking her now.
For a dinner party in the early 1800s okay. in
Strokes. This is like going back into Downton Abbey or something. You know, the way the behind the scenes kind of, that you could go into the kitchen and see what the servants got up to. Regina, this is, to be honest, I'm a great sucker for this kind of thing. I actually love it. But the menus, were they disgusting? Were they all jellied things and aspic and oxtails and lamb's hearts? Or were they food that we would still recognise today, or has food fashion changed so much?
Hi, Kira.
Am I making it sound awful? I don't know why I make it sound like frog spawn or something. There probably was nothing like that.
I love the house, Kira, because it has, like John was describing, it has one of the surviving gems of culinary history for Ireland, this almost intact 18th, 19th century kitchen. And in that kitchen, I think what we must remember is that you had a team of kitchen staff, cooks, kitchen maids, and other types of servants as well, who were working together as a team to create food that was highly sophisticated, very refined, and reflective of the best cooking that could come out of Irish landed estates, very similar to what was, very almost identical to what was happening in a British context in that area as well, like you mentioned, Downton Abbey and all that sort of stuff. And what we must remember is that, yeah, there's a tendency to think that food in the past was a bit disgusting. Not
sophisticated. Do you know what? I'm just revealing my own ignorance now and my own idiocy. I'm sure it wasn't at all.
Well, that is justified. If, you know, Hollywood has done a lot of damage to food history, I think. And also, I think if you look at sort of the base ingredients and what they're doing with them, we would find ourselves at a distance from things like the jellies that were being made and all of that kind of textual disgust that you described. But it's far from
I'm
that.
I'm so sorry, Regina. You're probably rolling your eyes going, oh, God, she mentioned the jellies. But you know the way people hear of those they were a bit more, and it's in vogue again, obviously. Weren't they a bit more nose to tail in terms of what they ate? I think that's the term.
Yeah, so everything is used and everything is converted. It is converted in such a sophisticated way that you actually don't know that the parts of the animal that are present are actually present. So one of the displays, for instance, in the new displays in Strokestown House are the jellies that you talked about. And a lot of those jellies would have started, like we think jellies come in a packet now, and they're associated with children and all sorts of stuff, or people who have sweet tooth. But if you think about jellies back in the 18th and 19th centuries, these were part of the second course, not just kind of sweety things, but the sweet was incorporated and served along with the savoury. And they would have started life as a calf's foot. A calf's foot.
Yeah, the gelatin, you were boiling it down.
Yeah. That had to go through all of these processes and then gets transformed and moulded and shaped and coloured before it's presented to the table as this beautiful item of craft.
Maybe I'm putting you on the spot, and forgive me, Regina, if I am, but could you give us a sort of a sample starter, main course, dessert, what people might have eaten? Is there a reasonable example of that, if I'm not asking too hard a question?
I call it out to you, and it's actually on display in Strokestown as well. And can I just say as well, Kira, that I've cooked a lot of these recipes, and we did cook for a television programme in Strokestown. It was called The Big House, actually.
Oh, The Big House. I think I might have seen this. I think I might have seen this. And I think this may be where I got the idea of the jellies. But go on, tell me the menu.
Okay, so the first thing I'm supposed to say is that the way that the ritual of serving food to the table was different to what we'd expect today. If we wanted to have a formal dinner, we'd have a main course, we'd have a starter, main course, and dessert. In the 18th and some of the 19th centuries, they have courses, But within each course are multiple dishes. So if you could imagine sitting down to a very refined, highly dressed table, the first thing might be soup.
Okay.
That you eat, and then that's it. Then it's removed, and then once the soup and the tureens and everything, the bowls and all that are removed, a whole series of dishes come to the table and they're laid down in front of the diners. Okay. Multiple dishes. So imagine sitting down at a very diverse hot buffet. So you see all of these foods in front of you, and you choose what you want from the table.
Okay.
And the diners at the other end will have. It's symmetrical. They will have the same arrangement and they choose. So for a first course, for instance, we'd have the soup. The soup is eaten and it's taken away. The first course then might be a collection of dishes that are based on the main cooking techniques like boiling, roasting, broiling and all sorts of stuff. So things like veal cutlets.
Okay.
A boiled turkey with celery and oyster sauce.
A boiled turkey.
Boiled turkey was very popular. It comes with a celery and an oyster sauce, so a separate sauce that's created on the side. Tongue with spinach and
this is what I was afraid of. I was afraid tongue was going to appear somewhere.
Yeah, but it won't look like the tongue in the animal's mouth. It will be cooked and it will be probably pressed and constructed to look, you know, the overt animal nature of it will be taken away.
Okay.
And tongue is a really... Well, for people who like meat, tongue is a really tasty piece of meat. It really is.
I'm going to take your word for that, Regina. That's what I'm going to do on that one. So,
we go into the second course, which might have a hare.
Oh, hare.
That might have a pudding in its belly. Jellies, apple cakes, sweetbreads, which are the parts of the animals which are really desirable as well.
Like pancreas and things.
Exactly, yeah. Or different glandular parts of the animal which are used to eat cooked refinedly, but also used for various different meat stuffings. And then they might have a collection of things like different types of fowl, smaller birds, and tarts, various different types of tarts.
Okay.
And then the sweet course could be a whole collection of things like highly sugar-based creations, even sugar constructions, different types of tarts, jellies, puddings, a whole array of them that you can choose from as well, almost like the sweet trolley on the table.
John, let me bring you back in. This is obviously a labour of love, doing something like this and restoring something like this and I suppose the desire to share it with people. Do you find, I imagine it's a great day out for families and people, because it's like seeing history come alive, isn't it?
Absolutely, Kira. It is a labour of love for everybody that's working there, and it is all about it's part of the Irish Heritage Trust kind of motto, I suppose. It's saving these places, making sure they're there for generations to come. We're the custodians now. We're minding them, and let's hope that we leave them in good fettle for the next generation. And I must say, Regina and the Irish Heritage Trust team have done a wonderful job on this, because there's more to Strokestown Park than Strokestown House. There's the walled garden, and that's been linked to the kitchen, because the walled garden was...
Well, they would have been very sustainable. They would have grown their own vegetables and their herbs and their what have you.
Absolutely. And part of the food props we in the walled garden back... When it was built first, it was a 6.5 acre walled fruit and vegetable garden growing pineapples.
That's a very big walled garden.
Pineapples, peaches, melons, figs.
So they had big orangeries or what have you, did they?
Glasshouses,
yeah.
Ranges of glasshouses.
Amazing.
And these were all being provided for the house throughout. But also in Strokestown, we are home to the National Famine Museum. And really, when you see what we've just talked about there, the grandeur, the food...
Okay.
Walk across the yard and you go into our old sable buildings and you hear a very different story. It's parallel lives, really. Those inside the estate walls in the house and those living outside the estate walls, in particular during the Great Irish Famine, a completely different story.
Good Lord. It sounds like a really, really good exhibition. Thank you both so much for bringing it to life for us this morning here on The Home Show. That is John O'Driscoll there, Irish Heritage Trust General Manager at Strokestown Park, and Regina Sexton, Programme Manager at the MA in Food Studies and Foodways in UCC. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you, Kira.
I'm so tired, I haven't slept a wink. I'm so tired, my mind is on the blink. I wonder, should I get up and fix myself a drink? No, no, no.
When it comes to interior design choices, one of the most, I suppose, contentious maybe, is that the right word, rooms is the bedroom, because most of us view this room as a sanctuary and we want comfort. But the problem is we won't always necessarily agree on how to create that comfort. But fear not, because help is at hand. Maria Fenlon is an interiors architect and the designer of a new bed cover collection called Enhance. And she joins me now this morning on The Home Show. Good morning to you, Maria.
Hi, Kira. So lovely to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming in. Now, I'm no Sinead Ryan. I'm a novice at all of this, but yeah. But I am really interested in design, and I'm really interested in interiors. And one of the rooms in my house that I fall down on regularly, it doesn't look as good as my living room,
yeah,
is my bedroom. And I love the idea of somewhere sort of plush and you could nest in it almost, and you go in there and it's some kind of an indulgent space. How do I create such a thing?
Oh my gosh, there are so many things that you can do to create the space of your dreams. And very, very important to consider the function of the room is number one. So obviously in design, it's a very, it's a lovely process where we work through mood and style and preferred style of our clients generally. And then obviously it's function and layout of the space. And obviously the first and most important thing in your bedroom is your bed. And most couples prefer, if they can at all, fit a 6-foot bed into their space. It is just so much more comfortable with kids and coming in and out and et cetera. So the bed is really important. Obviously the mattress and the quality. And there's so many different types on the market. There are soft mattresses, medium, firm. Again, you have to go out and try all of these
and
elements.
And is that the thing? So I totally agree with you on the bed. And I'm way past the stage of, I wouldn't tolerate a bad bed. Like, yeah. I honestly wouldn't, because my sleep is
no,
so precious.
Important.
Yeah. But do you recommend people go into a bed and just lie on beds?
You absolutely have to do it. And to be honest, I've worked in design for a long, long time. I started my business back in 2001. And the importance of trying every element in the room, sitting on a chair, lying on a mattress, is really important. And it's very individual. And some people like a firm, some people like a medium mattress. But I think for people who travel, and I work in the high-end residential area, people travel a lot and they're used to lying on good mattresses and finding good quality, you know, product throughout the world, and they want that in their own home.
I thought it was very interesting you mentioned, I think my bed is 5'5", five and a half feet.
Yes.
You mentioned people want a 6-foot bed. Is there, particularly in modern homes where bedrooms aren't enormous?
Yes.
Is there a trade off between a big bed that takes up a lot of space, but is great because if you're sleeping beside somebody, you've a lot of room in it, or a smaller bed where you might be a bit sort of more on top of each other without being rude, but you have more space in the room. Do people have to make that decision, that kind of trade-off?
It's a very important decision. And I suppose with design, it's one of the first things that we do. So form follows function, as they say. So we start off with the form and the shape of the room. And generally with our clients, we would try out different options, you know, different layouts for the room, and also consider sizes. So a 5-foot bed is about 150 centimetres wide by 2 metres long. And actually, funny, people are getting taller and taller. And I have met I've met people who are actually even looking for longer beds. So a 5-foot bed is about 150 wide and a 6-foot bed is 180 centimetres wide. So literally take a tape measure to your room and put it down. And then getting back to priorities, it's what's important to you. Do you want to work in the room? Do you need a desk, or is the comfort of the bed, you know, your priority?
I'm going to come to, I know the Enhance range and all of the beautiful work you've done and all
Thank
that
you.
Thing. I want to talk about kind of the textures and the textiles that make a room warm. But the other issue that someone like me has with their bedroom, where it is I have too many clothes, right? Just like, I don't know how to say this baldly, but I have too many clothes. Storage is an issue.
I'm like, obsessed. Yeah, that is an obsession for me.
But I want storage that's unobtrusive. Do you know what I mean? So how, well, I say lots of people do.
Again, working with the plan, that is so, so important. And obviously storage is key. And for me, I am obsessed. I have three now adult daughters, unbelievable. And you need to have a space to store your pieces. So a standard storage unit is 60 centimetres wide, deep. And that is the first consideration. And what we love to do in our design work is try to create storage units that allow maybe a piece of furniture to be the star in the show.
Yeah.
So it's very seamless and integrated and hidden.
And I like this.
Oftentimes we do sort of slatted wood walls where we integrate a door. So it's seamless entry into maybe a small walk-in wardrobe with mirrors. So the design of a bedroom, there's so many elements to consider.
And that's the dream. Huge. The walk-in wardrobe is the dream. And if someone is using an interior architect and they're going the full hog in terms of design and all of that kind of stuff, then they might be lucky enough to have that. But for people who just have a bedroom and they don't have, you know, they can't knock a door or a wall or have a second room. There are good options out there for, well, like mirrors and things. Would you recommend things like that in order to increase space or what have you?
Well, we lived in Belgium actually for 13 years. And for the last 5 years, I commuted over and back between Ireland and Belgium. And it was an amazing experience. But we have an apartment, a small apartment in Dublin. And obviously space was a real
priority. Yeah, so you had to be clever with it.
You had to be clever with space. So one thing that I would really recommend is an ottoman bed. It's incredible. So you think of the bed.
Is that the bed that you pull up
that you
the bed?
Lift up and the
I
amount
have one of these
storage.
Myself. I just didn't know what it was called.
Yeah, it's called an ottoman. It's incredible because you've all that storage space. Obviously, there are wall beds.
Yeah.
And if you have a second bedroom in a house, and
that's not a bad idea.
You can, it's called a Murphy bed. You can actually drop the bed down. It includes storage and it's a very, very useful.
So design now is such that there are really clever solutions.
To
every problem,
solutions.
There's a clever solution.
Very
I do have an ottoman
solution.
Bed and it is amazing.
It's incredible.
How much it holds. It holds
almost
half
bags.
My shoes, which is terrible to say because that's a lot of shoes.
Yeah.
Before I let you go, we must talk about the enhanced range because textiles in a bedroom can change the mood entirely, can't
textures
they?
Textures are everything to me. I love texture.
Me too.
I'm Irish. My background actually is art and design. I studied sculpture, so I love texture. I love materials.
Yeah.
And I've worked in the area of design for a long time. And I recently worked on an amazing project with a very well-known rock star who I can't mention.
Oof.
I can't mention
his name. We can all just guess.
But he told me he absolutely hated cushions in the bedroom. And he hated travelling to hotels and creating stacks of cushions that he was tripping over all the time.
I'm kind of with him, you know, because all you have to do is take them off, put them on,
take them off.
Life's too short.
Exactly, life's too short. So we decided, and also we at the end of all of our projects, we usually photograph to document the project. We found it very hard to find a bed cover, a stylish bed cover to cover the bed, to fall to the ground and then wrap over the pillows. So we decided to create one ourselves.
Yeah.
And we've been working on this product for the past 2 years. It's been so much fun for me. It's a cotton and linen mix with beautiful decorative embroidery, which help guides the placement of the bed cover on the bed.
So yeah, it's hard for people who are listening to see it in their minds, but it's almost got some geometric designs on it. But they're all done with beautiful embroidery.
I love design.
It's sort of like it struck me because of the materials and everything, like a homage to old Irish crafts, the embroidery and the colours, the neutral colours, but cool.
Yes.
It's like a bedspread, as I would have known from when I was a child, but you don't see them anymore. What you see nowadays, everything looks the same. They're all kind of duvets with, you know, pillows and a few scatter cushions and maybe a thing across the end. All beds, every hotel you go into, they all look the exact same. This looks like something, but it's like a reimagining of it because it is very sleek and very modern and very, as I say,
that
very cool.
Another very important
thing. But it reminds
me.
And I haven't seen anything like this on a bed in a long time.
Yeah.
Look, it's beautiful, Maria, and I'm delighted you came in to talk to me about it. We could have talked about bedrooms. It turns out we could have talked about bedrooms all day. Didn't even get onto my great love of fur in a bedroom, but there you go. Thank you very much for coming and the very
so
best
lovely.
Of luck with Enhance. And that is Maria Fenlon, their interior architect.
Thank you.
And now, I actually love this bit, we are joined by our very own influencer, Arlene McIntyre, to talk about the impact celebrities and online influencers are having on interior design. Arlene, you're very, very welcome. These are people, God love us, like the Kardashians and Gwyneth Paltrow and people like that. Are they, with their billions of euros, are they influencing ordinary people's homes?
I think they are. I think everyone is a little bit guilty of checking out what all of the bigger, you know, marketing monsters are doing in their homes. The Kardashians would be a really good example because they're a marketing machine. They have the top interior designers working with them, top homes, gigantic, you know, 20,000 square foot properties. So they are kind of selling a dream and living the dream. So people might get a little takeaway from that.
This is the ultimate, of course, in home porn, basically.
Exactly.
Isn't it? Because they have, first of all, they can change everything
yeah.
at the drop of a hat because money is no object. And they can be as, I suppose, avant-garde as
Correct.
You like. Is it a bit like, you know, designers on a catwalk and they have all these kind of wild geometric shapes or something and then some kind of watered down version of that ends up in pennies?
Exactly. Or Zara. And then Zara comes out with the knock-on of the Chanel.
Yeah, the dupes.
Totally.
So are we, is that what we see? We see
that is it.
Kim Kardashian lying on a sheepskin rug and then we all have like,
yeah.
you know,
she will set
nylon
trend.
Sheepskin rugs now. Is that kind of how it works?
Exactly. Like she's very minimalist and I'm not sure a lot of people would be with that many children as minimalist as she can afford to be. But yeah, I definitely think everybody can get a takeaway from whatever their style might be. May it be even like in the color palette, or if one of them has a new navy sofa, you can be guaranteed that navy sofas are going to take off.
You have a point, because I am thinking to myself now, and I would have been slightly like, ha, who would do such a thing? But now I'm just thinking of my couch. You mentioned sofas, mm-hmm. and I was thinking of my orange velvet, it's very bright orange velvet L-shaped couch that I love. And I'm thinking when I first saw an orange velvet L-shaped couch, it was in Vogue Williams' house on
go.
Instagram. And now I am just a cliche.
That's
what I actually am.
Ah,
no way. Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. There you go. Well, I have its probably much cheaper twin. But I'm very happy with that. So this does happen, because
it
in the same way we all go to Pinterest and look at like picture boards and wish lists and all that rubbish.
I know, and I see it so often when couples come in to me, and perhaps one will have a definite person that they've been influenced by, and it's on their Pinterest page, or they're showing me images on their phone. They're like, I just want Gwyneth Paltrow's dining room. Make that happen.
If people are listening this morning and you were going to advise them on good celebrities or influencers
yes.
to follow for interiors, are there people in particular that stand out?
Well, that's a really tricky question, because it's very individual and personal, and perhaps some people follow, you know, people that are, you know, athletes that inspire them, and they like to see how they live because their lifestyle maybe ties in with their lifestyle. So it's really, it ticks, there's a few boxes that need to be kind of ticked in order to get that influencer right. I would always tell my clients, please don't tell me what you like. Let's have a look at what you're trying to achieve, but don't get too caught up in trends or what somebody else is doing. Let's focus on your home, your light, where your windows are, where your fireplace is, your
yeah.
lifestyle.
You can't replicate someone
no.
else's room, because it's a different room.
It's impossible, but you can have little takeaways
of the style.
Exactly.
Which is very interesting. Yeah. Well, my own home, I live in a 1880s house, so I live in an old period property, an old
gorgeous
battered pile, really. But I still quite like so I have all period features, they're
yeah.
there, but I quite like a modern take on an old house. So mm-hmm. even though I have like wooden floors and cornices and all that
yeah.
kind of business,
gotcha.
I have quite modern bits of furniture in the house too. I have lots of mid-century stuff and stuff like
nice.
That. What I do when I'm going online, looking at this, I save an awful lot of interiors accounts. First of all, I follow an awful lot of interiors mm-hmm. accounts, but I also save various pictures and I almost do my own Pinterest, but I do
exactly.
it through the likes
is
of
like
Instagram.
Pinterest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I suppose do people come to you like that and go, I want this Cape Cod thing, or
yes.
this modern thing,
yes,
or this
100%.
But it really helps us narrow in on what their look is. So some people think they're mid-century, but they're actually really modern.
I like it, truthfully, eclectic. I would have yeah. like a, you know, an antique beside a mid-century
Love
beside
mm-hmm.
a weird thing I got in a market
it looks
or
collected.
Something.
Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of like, I don't like matchy-matchy.
Yeah. It's a definite look. It's a nice look and it looks collected and interesting. And
are there any, obviously people are following the Kardashians and Gwynnie and whoever, but mm-hmm. are there any particular trends that are that you see emerging, you know, obviously at different times, but currently?
I think we're moving slightly into more natural materials, anything that's sustainable. We're seeing a lot of wood coming back into the market. So wooden kitchens, you know, even a change and a shift in the color and the tones of wooden floors. So wood, like gray oak, which we would have seen for like
was
10
everywhere.
Years, is unfortunately gone.
Is it bad that I'm kind of, I never bought into the gray oak. I always thought it was a bit
cold.
Cold.
Yeah.
And bland.
Yeah, yeah.
And
50
and,
shades of gray.
Yeah. No, I listen, I have two gray rooms in my house. I have a charcoal gray room, so it's like being in a cave, and I have a more, also quite dark, but lighter grey room as well. So I'm not against grey because I do quite like, I had for a long time, probably like everyone else, a very light coloured house.
Yes.
And then I now favour for rooms that particularly I use in the evening, dark walls because
nice.
I think they bring it in.
The mood.
And I'm lucky because the old houses have quite big windows.
Gorgeous.
So there is a bit of light. But my floors are old kind of pine floors, do you know mm-hmm. what I mean? And I just, they're just, they're natural kind of thing. So the grige on the way out?
Well, we see a lot of people have already invested in
and
this
And that's the
trend,
problem, isn't it?
So it's quite tricky.
And is that the danger when you invest in, you know, the chevron kind of floors, the herringbone floors?
That's classic, that's forever.
Is that forever?
That's not a trend, that's forever. I was at a meeting recently in Poland, and we were in a very old
ancient
property,
and they were there,
all chevron, and it was just incredible to look at the craftsmanship. It's just that's timeless. So I think it's
so
more classics about the colors.
Classics
of the woods.
Don't come and go so much.
They do not.
If you have natural wood, of course, you can sand it and restain
yes,
it. So that is the problem is if you went with the grey oak laminates. You're stuck with them for a long time, but real wood you can take it back,
play around with it,
light and dark it,
exactly.
Whatever.
And if you get tired of a painted wooden, or rather a wooden kitchen, in 10 years' time you can paint it, or in 20 years' time you can sand it back and make it look like, you know, new.
That is the plus of, as you mentioned, natural
yes.
products, natural fibers. What would you call them? You know, like wood and
definitely
all of those
just
things.
Just keeping, you know, all of your textures as natural and as sustainable as you can.
And that move back to natural and sustainable, is that a move away from a more minimalist, do you think, to a warmer kind
yes.
of a
okay. Actually, I'm seeing
palette.
A lot of antiques coming in. So that's a big one to keep an eye out on. Warmer tones on floors, natural textures on your sofas and on your, you know, window treatments. So it's all about texture and earthiness and, you know, keeping that very neutral palette is coming back in. Anything very shiny and bling-tastic is perhaps making its way out.
Really?
Yeah.
I do like a bit of gold in a room.
Well, that's okay.
Just a little tiny bit of a...
Yeah, your cocktail room.
Incredibly flamboyant gold palm leaf chandeliers. Yeah, but look at... Very interesting, and as you say, it kind of does make sense, doesn't it? We're influenced in every other way by these people.
We sure are, you know.
Goodness, I feel like, I feel like quite the cliche. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, as ever, Arlene McIntyre, a rock of sense and also a vision of beauty. Thank you very much. Remember, if you'd like to get involved with the show, maybe you have a question for us, or maybe you have a topic that you'd like us to cover, or maybe you're a designer who would like to share your work with our listeners. And don't forget, you can drop the show a text on 53106 at a cost of 30 cents. You can WhatsApp us always at 087 1400 106, or indeed you can email us on thehomeshow@newstalk.com. That's my lot for this morning. I've had great fun talking interiors. I'm never usually allowed to do stuff like this here on News Talk, but I managed to wangle my way in this morning. Morning here, and I had a great time with all of you. But my thanks to my producer Aidan McElvey this morning, our researcher Rory Galvin, and Stephen McClune, who was on sound.
The Home Show with Sinead Ryan
with Mila,
Saturday morning at 8 on News Talk.